Are we really expecting me to have time and energy and knowledge to make decisions about every single one of them, especially considering the lengthy terms and conditions that each of those services usually has? But even if I had endless amounts of time and knowledge, then still my only option is to say yes or no. I cannot say, hey, Facebook, yes, I would like to join your platform, but actually section 2, paragraph 3 of your terms and conditions, that doesn't sit so well with me. Can we talk about that? Of course we can.
Voices of the Data Economy, a podcast supported by Ocean Protocol Foundation. We bring to you the voices shaping the data economy and challenging it at the same time. We talk about breaking down data silos and equalizing access to data for all.
Welcome, everyone, to the third episode. We have, as always, Diksha with us. And on this episode, Anouk. Anouk, really honored to have you here with us. I think it's a perfect next episode for our topic and the podcast. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about your own journey and where you are now, what you're focusing on.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me. I can definitely tell you a bit more about myself. My journey has been a bit of a roller coaster. I started out, came out of university having studied political science and economics, and I did that for a while. And then, kind of without knowing much about computers or how they work, I somehow randomly decided to teach myself programming, and then really enjoyed that, kept doing it for a while, made my living that way. But then at some point, I really missed all the social issues and working on more like economic and political issues. So I went back into journalism and kind of combined my now tech background with my social sciences background. And sort of from there, I started exploring a lot of topics around privacy and data, and especially corporate control over our data and over our digital lives, and that how that is affecting us as well as our democracy. So that's kind of how I started exploring this data governance topic. Yeah, and then from there, I just started looking into different models for doing things. I personally have a background living in co-living communities, and especially intentional co-living communities. And what that means is that we tend to experiment with different ways of resource sharing. So in one of the communities, there's a communal closet where everyone can just borrow clothes from the closet with the understanding that the clothes will be returned. And rooms are mostly left open, and they, even though everyone has sort of an assigned room, they don't belong to anyone. So they have their own names, and that's how we refer to the room. So there's many other experiments with how we can, as communities, share resources and make decisions about those resources. So I sort of started applying that background to the problem of how do we govern our data? And then kind of almost by accident walked into this whole legal world where a whole bunch of legal professionals, of course, have also thought about these things and come up with instruments for them. And so that's sort of where I'm now. I'm like, oh, wait, all of that is happening. How can we combine these things? How can we actually build them? And how can we connect the legal and the technical with like a governance layer? I know I'm being very abstract. I'm hoping that I can give you some examples later on to make this more clear. But that's how I arrived at where I'm right now. And I'm currently a Mozilla fellow working with Algorithm Watch in Berlin.
Yeah, great. I mean, that pretty much sets the context for everything we are going to discuss today, so you were not at all abstract. Talking about regulations and talking about the legal aspect of data that you just mentioned, so if I step back, to the year 2019, we had like a plethora of regulations, GDPR, CCPA, almost in every region of the world, and all of them focus on individual consent and how users should be aware of their rights. So how do you feel these regulations have actually played up? And if at all, have they had any impact on society as such?
As to the impact, I think it has had impact. A bunch of large companies have received fines. So that's a start. I tend to think of them more as not so much as focusing on individual consent as focusing on giving us all some basic rights, which I think are quite important. Like, it's a really good starting point. We needed to have some rights, and now we do. Obviously, we're still kind of at the beginning stages of this. So now we have those rights, which is great. And the next step is to actually enforce them. A lot of our data protection officers are receiving a lot of complaints, and there's an enormous backlog that, yeah. So basically, the laws that we currently have are not at the moment properly enforced. And so that, I think, is something that needs to receive a lot of attention. But then I think the other thing, and that goes more to the individual consent, like the way the rights are currently kind of implemented leads to placing the entire burden of making decisions about data on the individual without really much agency to negotiate on what terms that data is shared. So for instance, if you look at Facebook, I can basically decide whether or not I want to be on Facebook. And if I decide I want to be on Facebook, sure, there's some privacy settings I can tweak, but for the most part, I'm just surrendering a whole bunch of data about myself. And first of all, am I really in a good position to make all those decisions, especially considering I'm not just on Facebook, I'm using 100,000 different digital services every day. Are we really expecting me to have time and energy and knowledge to make decisions about every single one of them, especially considering the lengthy terms and conditions that each of those services usually has? But even if I had endless amounts of time and knowledge, then still my only option is to say yes or no. I cannot say, hey, Facebook, yes, I would like to join your platform, but actually section 2, paragraph 3 of your terms and conditions, that doesn't sit so well with me. Can we talk about that? Of course we can. So that's not a lot of choice. And then thirdly, there may not actually be a choice for me to be on Facebook. And this is less true for me than it is for other people. I know people who are part of support groups, who are part of support circles that rely heavily on using Facebook. And so basically, if they make the decision to leave Facebook, they would all of a sudden lose this support. So for them, the choice to join or not join Facebook is not really a choice. It's really not. And as we have learned with consent in other areas of our lives, if you cannot really say no, then your yes is kind of meaningless. So I think that is a huge problem with the way we're currently handling individual consent. And then there are even more problems which have far more to do, not so much to do with our inability to consent, and more to do with our data about us is usually not just about us. It's kind of interesting to me because this pandemic has kind of showed us how interdependent we all are. Like, my decision right now to go out onto the street and go for a walk may end up impacting the lives of others in kind of impactful ways. And that is sort of true for our data as well. Like, I can decide to share my data because honestly, I'm pretty privileged. I'm not really part of many at-risk groups. So me sharing my data is usually, for me, is usually all right. But first of all, when I share my data, I'm also sharing data about other people. A lot of my data is communication data. If I decided to share my DNA data, which is kind of the most obvious example, I end up sharing DNA data about my entire family, and not even my current family, also my future, as of yet, unborn family members. And so how is it that I get to make that decision, and that is not a decision they get to make as well? So yeah, that is a bit problematic if you only look at individual consent. And then to take that even further, when I share data about myself, even if that data is aggregated and anonymized, which, I mean, we can talk a lot at length about whether you can actually anonymize data, but let's pretend for the moment that that in the magical world, that's possible. You could still, I'm a 30-something-year-old hipster. You could still, by aggregating my data with a bunch of data about other 30-something-year-old hipsters, you may be able to infer a lot of things about 30-something-year-old hipsters. And a lot of those other hipsters may never have shared data about themselves. And to give you an example of why this could be a problem, if you look at health insurance, we have right now the ability to share things like our Fitbit data, data about what we're eating, how healthy we are directly with our health insurance companies. So this is definitely a thing in the UK. I don't think it's a thing in every country. And at the moment, those health insurance companies don't really give you a discount in premium, but they will give you all sorts of fun perks like free cappuccinos and tickets to the movies. And that's great. And I can individually decide like, yeah, I'm healthy. I want my health insurance company to know about that. Great, let's do it. But what about the people who decide not to share that data because maybe they aren't that healthy? Like, once everyone who is healthy shares their data, you can make a lot of inferences about the people who haven't shared their data. You can start to assume that maybe they aren't so healthy. And then maybe two steps away from like movie tickets is, well, should we reduce the premiums for the healthy people, increase the premiums for not so healthy people? And suddenly you're in a world where, I mean, we could decide that that's the world we want, but I'm very sure that the people who have decided not to share their data make no such decision. So even when we individually consent to things that make sense for us, they may still not make sense for us collectively. And so I think data rights are great and we need them, but there needs to be a step, a level up where we don't just make decisions about for ourselves, but we make decisions that work for us collectively. And we need mechanisms that help us negotiate between our individual needs and rights and the rights and needs of us as a society. And I think right now the focus on that is just kind of lacking.
So in a way, you say that individual consent is not really the solution. And I also read some of your pieces. And in fact, your main piece on Top Twitter is about the case for collective consent. You touched a bit on that, but could you elaborate that with some specific examples that how could actually collective consent work in solving the situation you just spoke about?
Right. So that's the really hard problem, right? It's really easy to point out the problems. It's hard to come up with good solutions. And the answer really, really differs. So there are cases where you could say that the consent should just be given by the individual because the data is really just about them. The decision to share data only impacts them. And maybe in this case, they do have enough information and time to make those decisions. And there's not such power asymmetry between them and who they share to warrant another model. So those cases exist. And then on the other end of the spectrum, and I think this is sort of true for the insurance case I just mentioned, I think the collective in that case is our society. And in that, I think for those cases, we should just have a government step in and say, no, never that. There could be, it's quite easy to imagine having some regulation to deal with that. But that leaves a whole bunch of cases in this gray zone between the individual and like a government stepping in. And in those cases, I think it's often not so super helpful for a government to regulate every single one of them. To give an example, let's say you have patients with a very specific disease that is as of yet not cured. And for them, it may make a lot of sense to share their data freely and willingly with academic researchers who can help find a cure for that disease. But sharing comes with risk. It comes with the risk that whatever publication is based on that data, they may be identified. But more than that, it comes with the risk that the data will also be shared with their employers or their future employers or other types of insurance providers. And they may not want that. So they have very specific needs around what data they want to have shared and what data they don't want to have shared. And when I say specific, I really mean specific for this group of people, not necessarily specific for society as a whole. And I think for those cases, we can start to look at different governance models. And fortunately, there's a wide body of research on something called the commons, which is basically like most of that research has nothing to do with data. So I'm going to take a bit of a step back and explain this. So Eleanor Ostrom, who is was a Nobel Prize winning economist, proved and showed in her research that it's possible for a group of people to collectively sort of govern a common resource. And by common resource, I don't mean an open resource and everyone should be able to use it. I mean, let's say you have a piece of land and a couple of people want to use that land to sunbathe and a couple other people want to use that land for the cows to graze on. And I don't know, maybe a couple other people have some other use for it. Those people all come together And there's many different ways for them to reach decisions, but all together decide how that lens should be used, what the rules are for the use of the lens. And then also either decide or rely on enforcement mechanisms to enforce those rules. And so, as Eleanor Ostrom has shown us, that doesn't lead to a tragedy of the commons where everyone just takes what they want and the land gets plundered. It actually leads to pretty good sharing of resources. So the question then is, how do we apply this to data? Is there such a way as where we can say, well, these are the relevant actors for this bit of data? How do we bring them together and allow them to either collectively decide about their data or to assign someone to decide for them, et cetera, et cetera. So that's how my research started. And then I started looking into something called the data trust, which is sort of a version of that, but with a large legal component. So in a trust, basically what you do is you say, well, I have all these data rights that I've now been given by something like the GDPR or other data protection laws. And these data rights are great, but I don't want to make all these decisions. And I want to make sure that the decisions I make also work for other people. So it can say like, okay, I'm going to hand over sort of the management of this right to another person. So I could hand them over to you, like, hey, please make decisions on my behalf. I trust you to be very good at this. Now, I can do that, but I have very little guarantee that you will make decisions that I agree with that are actually good for me, and you won't just run off and do whatever the hell you want. And that's a bit problematic. So luckily, this problem has in a way been solved by the conception of a legal trust. In a legal trust, and we're talking about the same things that rich people put their money in to make available to their children, that's the legal trust. Basically, you give an asset to a trustee, and what's beautiful about the trustee, they have a legal duty, which is called a fiduciary duty, to look after your sole interest. And what that means is that they themselves cannot have any interest in anything to do with whatever asset, or in this case, right, you put under their governance. So, for instance, like a good example of a fiduciary would be your doctor. Like your doctor has to make decisions that work for you and cannot also at the same time benefit from making those decisions. They cannot do things that benefit themselves. So for instance, it's illegal for a doctor, for the most part, to accept fees from insurance companies or drug trials. That's actually the most common example, is doctors going for fancy lunches with pharmaceutical companies or receiving all sorts of gifts to induce them to give their patients that specific drug. That's actually that violates their fiduciary duty to look after the sole interest of their patients. Now, if they were also looking after the best interest of their patients, they may actually be allowed to do this if the drug in question would be good for the patient. But they have to look after the sole interest of their patients. And this is the same for a data trustee. So whoever you entrust with the rights about your data would look after your sole interest. Or in the case of a data trust, where it's not just you handing over those rights, but it's a whole collective of people, the data trustee would look after the sole interest of that collective, which we usually call the beneficiaries of the data trust. So that gives you kind of a mechanism to allow for you not having to make 100,000 decisions all on your own. What it also does is it now groups a bunch of people together. Let's say you have 1 million Facebook users in a data trust that governs or controls and makes decisions about how the data that is created by Facebook can be used and how it cannot be used. All of a sudden, you have an actor who has to act in the best interest of the people the data is about. And they can be the ones who go to Facebook and say, look, we want to agree with your terms and conditions, but these million people kind of have a problem with Section 2, Paragraph 3. Can we maybe start rewriting that? And suddenly you have a seat at the negotiation table. So for me, more than just a way to avoid having you make a ton of decisions, it's also kind of acts a little bit like a trade union in that it can have this collective bargaining power as well.
Exactly. You kind of read my mind, or I read yours, and you said it. So it's really interesting you went in this direction of data commons, if you could call them that. I actually promised to send this episode to Christopher Mims. He's a journalist at Wall Street Journal. We had a call, and then we were talking about this interesting idea of data monopsony. Which seems to be a new idea. We might have coined even the word data opsony. And when we were talking, it came to exactly this idea of data commons. Or we actually even have this in a way as an effort by a bunch of really cool AI people. They call it AI commons. Ocean Protocol is also involved. Mm. But what was missing in that effort, or in general in these types of efforts, is looking at data as just land, I don't think that works. There are different characteristics to data that need much more granular control. I mean, your data could be used for a million different things, and then the results of those could also be combined, and, you know, there is an infinite space of possibilities. So, but if I understand correctly, data trusts are this kind of operating system that are on top of data commons that govern all those questions that might come up that we don't even know what they are, right? And in this way, we're complementing the raw material, which is data, with the governance layer. Is that also the way you see this?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So the data trust I just described really is just a legal, it's a legal relationship. But it doesn't tell you anything yet about how the data itself is governed, right? Like, it tells you that whoever's in charge has to make decisions on the best interests of the beneficiaries, but how they make decisions, we can define that for ourselves. Given this a bit of thought, I don't think there's one definitive answer. Like, different data trusts for different purposes are going to come up with different ways of making decisions. Mm-hmm. I think one way, especially like the example I just gave with the people with a incurable disease, let's say that is a very specific group of people who care deeply about this disease being cured, and as a result care deeply about their data and want to and are kind of committed to spend quite some time figuring out who to go to and shouldn't go to, which is absolutely not true for a lot of the data that is collected about us in every day, right? Like, a lot of my browser data, I care a lot about it not falling in the wrong hands, but I don't care enough to spend my days deciding where it goes and where it doesn't go. But for this specific data, that may be the case. We may care just about enough. And in that case, you could see a data trust being governed in a slightly more democratic way, where anyone the data is about kind of actively votes for specific decisions. Whereas in other cases where we care a little less, maybe we're just not that aware, the governance structure could look a little different. And I could, for instance, see kind of a mix between giving individual consent, sort of in the way we do now, except the difference being we can trust the data trust to actually uphold our consent. And then having an extra layer of decision-making where a board of trustees that's either like that could be made up of either experts and maybe also people from the community
or
to make
AIs.
Extra decisions. To make extra decisions, like an extra layer of decisions that looks more at the risk for like more vulnerable populations, like for instance the people not who don't want to share their data with health insurance companies. So we can start to balance those a little better.
You know, when you start talking about generally the idea of collective consent, it kind of felt like it's sharing your data is almost inevitable, either directly or indirectly, because you are a member of some minority group. I think all of us are members of at least a number of a smaller group of individuals that makes us more easily identifiable. So in this way, it reminds me of, I mean, it kind of looks like just democracy, because I'm not a huge fan of, you know, giving everyone the same weight well, in democratic systems, but everyone should have a vote because you do not really choose. You do not have the option of really opting out of being born into a country. It's really difficult to opt out of. I'm Iranian, so I'm for life. I'm Iranian. It's hard. I can't even lose my passport. But so if this is the case also for data, which increasingly is, it is that, you know, whether you want it or not, even if you choose the nice opt-out thing on Firefox and Chrome, data is still collected about you. So does it mean that data trusts are essential? Like, I mean, they're inevitable. They must exist. And then the question for me is, why aren't there any data, any data trusts? And if there are, like, why are they so tiny? And like, they don't really seem to have much impact in our day-to-day lives.
Right. Lots to unpack. Good questions. Let me start with the, isn't this basically our democracy all over again? I agree with you. Like, I think we've made this mistake of focusing a lot on the individual and kind of forgotten how countries work in the first place. Like, we, our governments, our citizens every day kind of make these tough trade-offs between different needs and different interests. And I don't see why that would be much different for data. Like I said, I don't necessarily think every decision should be taken by a government, because yeah, there's kind of these ad hoc little groups of people that have shared interests and needs and would share data for very specific purposes. So there are some differences for sure. But yeah, I think your larger point absolutely stands. What was your second question? Why are they so tiny? That was the question, right? Yeah. So so data trusts are a really nice idea. I think data commons, which for me, a data trust, and this is highly contentious and many people disagree with me on this, but for me, a data trust is part of a data commons. It's just a specific legal model, but
it's kind of the governance layer of any data commons or data sharing agreement.
No, it's the legal protection layer, basically. So it's basically that whoever you put in charge of a data commons, like whatever governance layer decides, whoever gets to make the decisions with a data trust, they would have some legal duty to also to actually look out for the people they say they will look out to. So it's kind of this, yeah, extra protection. But ultimately, the thing itself could very much function as a data commons.
So could we say we need like a data bill of rights for the entire human race, in a way, or at least for countries that have the ability to pass such laws?
Right. I think that's sort of, and I think it's a little bit what we're trying to do with things like the GDPR. I honestly don't know. So I think we should have rights, and that's the building block, and that's the block that we build all these other things on top of. On the other hand, the thing with bills of rights is that they're usually, I think we should have human rights, and those should include how we deal with our data. And that could be a bill of rights, sure. But if we make it very specific to data, we're going to write laws that are very specific to how we're currently sharing data. And my slight worry is that 10 years from now, we're doing the things very, very different, and now we need to update all these laws. And updating laws, especially these kind of fundamental ones, is hard and takes a long time. So basically what I'm saying is I don't know. Like, I'm not a legal scholar. I haven't figured this out. But it's a very good question to ask, and you should definitely ask someone who has a legal background. To your point of why do data trusts exist, and if not, why not? And if yes, why they're so small? The answer is yes, they do exist. The Open Corporates has created something that is essentially a data trust. They place all their intellectual property and data under the control of a trust. And then they also have a company that gets to use the data and the IP, but only under the conditions set by the trust. So that is a good example of how that might work. There are others as well. The Facebook Oversight Board that's been receiving a lot of attention in the last few days is essentially a data trust. The board itself is a trust, so it functions more or less like I just described. And I would say it's a data trust because it's basically making decisions about data, which is in this case content, and how that data should be used. I think one major flaw of the oversight board right now is that it gets to enforce policy, but it doesn't get to set the policy. So the policy is still set by Facebook, which I think is a little, it's a shame, really. Like, they should really have given all those amazing humans, because there are really some amazing humans on those that board, they should have given them a little bit more power to also set policies. I do think they can advise on policies, but that's not quite the same. But yeah, so these things do exist. I think the reason they do not exist at scale is, first of all, because we're all just figuring this out. Second of all, because there are some quite legal challenges that we need to figure out in order for them to exist at scale. One of them is that trust law is mostly something that exists within a common law jurisdiction. And so civil law countries, which is most of Europe, don't have trust law. They have versions of trust law, and they have versions of this fiduciary duty I talked about. And so I do think we can create something similar out of that, but that has yet to happen. And the other thing is, if you look in Europe specifically with the GDPR in place, so one of the proposals for a data trust, and this one has mostly been pioneered by Sylvie Delacroix, who you should probably also have on this podcast, but her proposal was to, instead of putting data in a data trust, to put those data rights under, kind of in the data trust. But that, and those rights would be the rights given by the GDPR. The slight problem that we run up against with this is that the GDPR itself has purpose limitations. So I, as an individual, can say, well, you can use this data for XYZ for a specific duration of time. Specific purpose, specific person. But I cannot just say, well, here are my rights. Please do what you want. Or I'm handing over the rights over the specific piece of data for the purpose set out in the trust, but that may still be much broader than the purpose I'm allowed to give that data away with. The sentence got really complicated under the GDPR. So there's some things to figure out there as well. It's by no means figured out either. I've asked a bunch of people who really should know these things and are also just figuring it out. So yeah, I think there's still a lot to figure out. And these are all quite new areas that combine a lot of different disciplines. So they can combine knowledge of legal systems with knowledge of how technology works, with knowledge of like, what are the business models for these things? Are these trusts going to be funded by the government? Are the companies that end up using the data going to somehow pay a fee into these trusts? Like, how is that going to work? We haven't quite figured that out. The governance models themselves, I think we have a lot of examples for good governance kind of in the wild in different contexts that we can use. But yeah, combining all these things, it takes a lot of different people from a lot of different disciplines actively working together and all speaking a language the other groups can also understand. It kind of means training a whole bunch of people into this type of work, which is going to take a little bit of time. But it's by no means impossible. So that's kind of the difference.
Okay. So as you said, I know that data trusts exist in some form or the other, like you just gave some examples. I'm curious, like, how dependent is the success of data trust models on collective consent? And like, if you could talk a bit about the interrelationship between the two, and if collective consent really is not, we are not there right now, can data trust still work?
So collective consent is not something that is rewritten into law in any way. It's just a word I came up with. But so for me, it's more, I think I'm going to rephrase your question a little bit. So for me, it's more, it's not so much, if it doesn't exist yet, can data trust even work? It's more, it should exist. We should have a way to navigate it's kind of the externalities of us sharing data individually. And we need ways to navigate those externalities. And I think we can only do that when we make decisions on a more collective scale rather than just an individual scale. And data trust will help us do it. So it's not so much that data trust can only exist if we somehow make that a requirement, it's that they will help us do it. And maybe, yeah, we can at some point write that into law. I would not really know what that would look like. But yeah,
Okay. So Anouk, if we could switch the topics a little bit, I'm curious to know, like, where are you seeing the issues around data trust and collective consent applying to the current pandemic situation with COVID-19?
Right. So interestingly, I think in Canada, some people are building a data trust to hold the data related to contact tracing apps, which is both interesting because I like it when people start experimenting with data trust because we get more insights into how they might work and also how they may not work. Like, we're probably going to learn a bunch of things. At the same time, what has been really worrying for me while like watching this pandemic unfold, but mostly watching government's responses to this pandemic, is that like just the immediate urge to jump to building an app as the solution for everything. It's almost a whiplash inducing. It's like, not again. I thought we were done with this. I thought we had the techlash and we all decided we're not going to just randomly build apps to solve problems. And I think the contact tracing app is probably one of the worst instances of that. I'm sure people are doing that with the best of intentions. Like, it's usually built by pretty well-meaning people. But before we start coming up, so basically what happened is like someone decides to build a contact tracing app. And then a bunch of privacy activists fall over themselves to point out why that's a very bad idea. And then in sort of this third phase, you have a bunch of people deciding how to make the bad idea slightly better by doing things like decentralized storage, which is really pretty okay idea. But then also data trust. And that's all great, but it kind of ignores the first question, which is, do we really need this? And is it going to really solve the problem we're setting out to solve? So kind of in my hope is that we would build a data trust and then the data trustees would take a look at why the data is collected and what it's supposed to solve and be just like, nah.
that sounds really interesting. So you're kind of inversing the kind of, we're building solutions that become problems. And what you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, is if we had data trust right now and they would have the access to resources to do simulations and see if, you know, these solutions are meaningfully impactful, they would do this. And then the data trust would have the authority to decide yes or no, or maybe more like shades of gray. It will only share data with like a 50 meter granularity, not more than that. That doesn't really help.
Well, so this is kind of, even in your question, the concern is mostly with individual privacy, whereas here I just think I'm concerned about that for sure, but the question before that is just, is this an appropriate response? And so we can talk about how many meters of distance we should be measuring, but should we first decide whether this is a good idea to begin with? And I don't think it is. I'm absolutely not. I'm not a medical professional. I have no knowledge of viruses, but my just kind of basic level common sense tells me that if you don't do testing, then you can trace all you want, but you don't really know where you're tracing. A lot of our governments are actually not testing properly. And then
contact tracing doesn't actually need to be with apps. In Germany, they used to just get people's names on a list. So, or in China, they do it too aggressively. But you could imagine only doing this when you are entering a hot zone, like a mall or something like that. But I think the argument from, if I could be, they're not devil, but if I could be devil's, the argument is we are doing testing, but testing without contact tracing is useless. That's kind of the reasoning. But you're also right that it seems like this app is like a gimmicky, nice IT solution that we can build and yay, you know, like we're now awesome to kind of compensate for not doing enough testing. It doesn't really work if you don't do enough testing.
That's precisely it. Like, you do need the testing. And then I agree with you, like there's a lot of ways to do manual contact tracing. And so I think it's Singapore, they did that, and then they used an app to kind of help people help people remember where they had been the last 2 weeks. So it's not so much of like, oh, here is a list. It's more like, okay, we're going to go through your life. And then from those people, you get a lot of additional context. It's like, well, were you standing there like outside of a supermarket? Was it like an area that was covered by a roof or not? Like all these things matter a lot. So yeah, there are ways to do this well, especially if you're also doing testing. But a lot of the proposals I've seen look like ways to do it wrong. But what really, really annoys me, and this goes far beyond the scope of data trust, is this: while we're talking about contact tracing apps, like what are the things we're not talking about? There's such an opportunity cost to both talking about these things, not just to talking by governments, but talking by all of us. And also the opportunity cost of actually building them and putting funds towards them. And there's so many things we already know we should be doing. Testing is one of them, but also there's so many people who are in desperate need that we need to be supporting. And I continue to be amazed that it's the app we talk about and not the fact that our essential workers are not receiving enough protection and often not enough compensation, or that seasonal workers right now are really at risk to get COVID because they're basically living on top of each other. Like, I mean, it's not that it's not a conversation, but it's just that the conversation gets crowded out a lot by talk about magical tech solutions. And I find that both upsetting and a little scary, to be honest. And that's not necessarily a problem that's going to be solved by a data trust. That's a problem that's going to be solved by us changing the conversation. I think continuously bringing this up, maybe. I don't really know. Maybe you have some solutions.
Yeah. I think this tendency of over-engineering or jumping to technical solutions for every problem, that is what happens all the time. I'm guilty of actually organizing just another COVID-19 hackathon, but focused on privacy-preserving technologies. That might be actually a good segue to this topic we discussed with Andrew on our first episode. I'm curious to know, like, what do you think about this question? Why would companies like Facebook and Google voluntarily support creation of things like data trusts or data unions, data co-ops, whatever we want to call them? Like, what is the intrinsic value they have? Like, their board members have fiduciary responsibility for maximizing shareholder value and all of that crap. So why would they voluntarily decide to support things like this? I kind of have a bit of an answer myself, but first I want to hear from yourself.
Well, quite frankly, I don't think they would. That's my first answer. However, I don't think they would, but maybe because I think data is still very much seen as this hugely valuable asset that investors that have invested in your company are going to require you to hold on to. So once you got those investors on board, or once you got the fiduciary responsibility to make a profit, kind of hard to say, well, we're going to just give that data to a data trust and they'll manage it and we'll be fine. And we're going to give a lot of control away, basically. However, there seems to be a little bit of a change in thinking around this. Andreessen and Horowitz, the VC funders that everyone in Silicon Valley is well aware of, came out with a blog post quite a while ago saying, like, just collecting tons and tons of data as a startup is not the best strategy. Like, actually making better use of a little bit of data, and I think they went even so far as like just sharing data with other people, maybe much better strategy. So this whole notion of, if you have a lot of data, you're just going to be more valuable just because you have a lot of data. Yeah, exactly. They kind of undermined that idea. And that's interesting because that create some room for not maybe the Facebooks right now, but at least starting companies to do things a little different. And I think for me, that's also where I'm looking at most, because there are a lot of companies out there that want to do things differently. Sometimes just because their founders are people who want to do things differently and have a social mission. Sometimes because the promise they make to their customers is like, look, we're privacy aware and you don't have to trust us. Like, you don't have to trust that we uphold our promises, as we have seen companies not do so many times. So we'll put it in a trust, and you can trust the trust as well as the kind of legal protections that gives you. So, yeah, I think for them, it might make a lot of sense to experiment with these things. Another place where I think we have some leverage, although maybe more hope is the moment our governments do start sharing data with governments, we can say, look, instead of having a data sharing agreement that basically transfers a bunch of our public data, but also quite personal data to companies, instead of just doing that, we can put the data in a data trust and have these kind of impartial trustees make decisions about it. And so they hold control rather than the company now holding all the control. And I'm specifically thinking about things like what's happening in the UK right now. The NHS, which is the National Health Services in the UK, announced about a month ago that they are building this huge data store to collect all sorts of data about COVID-19 patients and hospital responses. And they're basically combining a whole bunch of data that either the NHS already holds or is newly collected. And they're giving access to this data store to companies like Palantir and Amazon and Google. And they say they have done that without surrendering control over the data. So the idea is that the NHS will maintain all the control. But so far, that's just something they wrote in a blog post. And that's been contradicted by a bunch of other documents that have since been uncovered by The Guardian. So basically, we don't really know. And I'm like, this would be an amazing opportunity to use these different alternative data governance models to make sure that the data isn't suddenly held by Palantir and that Palantir doesn't suddenly get to decide how that data is used and accessed. So yeah, and I think that's a way. And I think our elected officials, because it is in our like kind of society's best interest to do that thing differently, instead of giving away all our power, to just say, no, stop. We're protecting it, and we're protecting it in this way. Unfortunately, I don't think that's the direction things are going right now, which, quite frankly, should be the subject of a huge public debate. But, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The concern is more towards your first answer, a little bit also second one. Giving away any kind of control and trusting is where the problem is. There's this really cool concept. I don't know if it's specific to blockchain space, but at least in blockchain space and privacy preserving technologies in general, there's the idea of can't be evil versus don't be evil. Right. You know, Google had this thing like don't be evil. Now they're not even that. It's like they're just like plain evil. But what about approaches that are mathematically provable that they cannot be evil? At least you can have some level of assurance. And in a way, I also really like both like the mention of the Andreessen Horowitz article about data moats being overrated, and what you said, these different approaches that are in a way data light instead of data heavy. Right. That was like, you know, big data, and like everyone was raising funding if you had a huge pile of data. And there are interesting approaches using privacy preserving machine learning, for example, and also other cognitive science-based approaches. Gary Marcus is a key figure there. He's always arguing, you know, you will never, you know, achieve artificial general intelligence with tons of data and just like deep learning. So these are really interesting, I guess, technical approaches that are also aligned with our really awkward moments right now. My Google, for some reason, activated. I don't. Oh my god, this was hilarious. Okay, so I guess Google just learned about our evil plans to stop their.
Yeah, it's usually when they step in. It's just quite immediate. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, so I guess this is also a good place to wrap up, Anouk. We will definitely follow up with some of the people you mentioned, also the topics. I think this idea of data light startups or new companies is really interesting. In a way, if data is the new oil, we should consume much less of it, because, you know, see what oil did to planet Earth. I think we're doing the same to humanity. Anything that you would like to plug in, you know, projects that you're working on, and also your maybe social media handles?
Right. So first of all, I don't think I've heard data described as the new nuclear waste, and I thought that was quite accurate.
Oh.
As far as the things I want to plug, I am working on a bunch of pilots for data trusts. that I'm talking about on Mozilla has a thing called Mozilla Pulse. If you type in my name there, you will find out more information. And I have a Twitter handle as well, which is Anubruhak, which is impossible to just spell right in one go. So it's A-N-O-U-K-R-U-H-A-A-K, where I talk a lot about data trust. And at the moment, I'm bitching a lot about the increased surveillance measures taken by our governments.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. This was amazing.
Same here. Diksha, anything from your side?
No, pretty much not. But I think it's always a nice idea to leave the podcast with like a one-line message that you want to leave the audience with in terms of, say, in this case, it could be how to think before giving consent of your data. That would be like, nice.
Like an inspirational quote, yeah. If you want.
Yes. Okay. I now need to think about my inspirational quote. I think the inspirational quote is here. It's like, alone we're not very effective and we'll not get a lot done. But if we work together, we can achieve enormous amounts of things.
I couldn't agree more with that. Yeah. Our strength is in numbers. So, thanks to both of you for, joining us in this episode, and thanks to Ocean Protocol for supporting this, and see you or talk to you in the next episode. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.